Friends, we are all human beings. And as human beings, our main concern, our main function, if you like, is to grow as human beings, to develop, to evolve. And that means, sooner or later, in one form or another, following what is usually called a spiritual path, or, in the terminology that we have been using more recently, pursuing the path of the higher evolution of man. In the course of the last few years, in discussing this process of growth, development, higher evolution, we've operated, as it were, with the help of three main concepts. First of all, there's the concept of a state of unconsciousness or unawareness. Secondly, a state of self-consciousness or awareness, or if you like, of individuality or true individuality. And thirdly, and lastly, there's the concept of what we may describe very provisionally and inadequately as the state of universal consciousness or Buddhahood. And the higher evolution itself consists, as we've seen on a number of occasions and from various points of view, consists in the whole overall process of development from the state of unconsciousness through self-consciousness to universal consciousness, or, if you like, from unawareness through awareness, through individuality, up to Buddhahood itself. And as I mentioned last week, we shall soon have to start operating with the help of a fourth concept, a concept which we haven't so far introduced into our consideration of the higher evolution, and that is the concept of what Jung calls, again a provisional term, the collective unconscious. And when we speak of the collective unconscious, we include what Jung also calls the archetypes of the collective unconscious, the shadow, the anima or animus, the wise old man, the young hero, and so on. Sometime we shall have to try to understand what part they also play in the process of the higher evolution. But this is something we shall have to do later on, maybe next winter. Meanwhile, we're going to start moving in that direction. We're going to start familiarizing ourselves with, as it were, archetypal material in general. And we're going to study, therefore, in our present series of lectures, the parables, the myths, and the symbols of the White Lotus Sutra. Now, the White Lotus Sutra is a Mahayana Sutra, that is to say, a Mahayana scripture. So, last week, in the course of the first lecture in the series, we had something to say about the Mahayana, especially about the universal perspective of the Mahayana. And we saw that the word Mahayana itself, which is a Sanskrit word, means simply the great way. And that it constitutes, in historical terms, the second of the three great stages of the development of Buddhism in India. We were especially concerned to point out last week that whereas all forms of Buddhism are in principle universal, Buddhism itself being a universal teaching, the Mahayana, the great way, is more effectively universal, more universal in practice than the Hinayana or the little way. We saw last week that this was because the Mahayana stressed in its teaching, in its practice, in its spiritual life, both wisdom and compassion. And we saw that in so doing it followed faithfully the example of the Buddha himself. We saw that after his enlightenment, after his own awakening to the truth, to the ultimate reality of things, the Buddha did not remain, as it were, silent. He did not sit still. He did not wait for people to come to him. The Buddha went out to them. He went forth to communicate the truth that he had discovered to other human beings. Went forth out of compassion. So the Mahayana is just like this. It follows the example of the Buddha. It does not wait for people to come to it. It goes out to them. And it goes out in many different ways, in many different forms. We saw that even in ordinary linguistic terms, the Mahayana goes out to people. The Mahayana doesn't expect people of different countries to learn its language in the literal sense, the language of its scriptures. It speaks their languages, it translates its scriptures into their languages, into Tibetan, into Chinese, into Mongolian, into Japanese, and so on. And not only does it speak many different languages literally, but it speaks many different languages metaphorically too. There are two great languages that humanity uses, that the Buddha himself used, and we find the Mahayana using, communicating in both of them. It communicates in the language of concepts through its intellectual teaching, its philosophy, and it also communicates in terms of images. In the first language, the language of concepts, it addresses, we may say, the head. And in the second language, with the help of the second language, the language of images, it addresses the heart, even the unconscious. So we see that the Mahayana, like the Buddha himself, employs on occasion these two great languages, these two great means of communication, the concept and the image, or the idea and the image. And in this way, it reaches, it is able to communicate with a very large number of beings.